Hello and welcome to this edition of Sit for Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. My name is Mark and I will be hosting today's episode. So a very warm welcome to you all and thank you for joining me. In this episode, we will be looking at the upcoming spending review and hearing from two of SIPFA's very own managers who will be explaining what a spending review actually is and why you should care. We have Joanne Pitt, who is our local government policy manager, and also Eleanor Roy, who is SIPFA's Health and Social Care Policy Manager. But first up, we're joined by Samantha Misocki, who is Project Director at Humantum. She is in conversation with SIPFA's very own Junior Communications Officer, Ursula Dale.
Hello, I'm joined today by Samantha Misocki, who is the Project Director on the Humantum side of the Humanta and SIPFA Partnership, IFR for NPO. Thank you very much for joining us today, Samantha.
It's great to be here.
It's been a while since we've had you on the podcast. Would you be able to give our listeners an update on the IFR for NPO project?
Absolutely. So I think we launched the project back in 2019. Since then, SIPFA and Humantum, we've been working together to develop the world's first internationally applicable financial reporting guidance for the non-profit sector. And I think the last time we chatted, we just formed the international advisory groups and we were in the early stages of drafting a consultation paper. Now, I don't think at that stage we realised it was going to turn out to be 280 pages long, but there were a lot of issues and alternatives to set out, right from, you know, very fundamental questions of what do we mean by nonprofit organisations, who are the readers, and what makes them so different that IFRS or IPSAS can't meet their needs. So we launched that consultation paper in January of this year, together with a raft of videos and events, and we got final responses just last week. And we're really delighted that nearly 1,000 people from 96 countries participated in all our engagement events. And we received responses from, I think it's 155 organisations and individuals from 33 countries. So that's been a really great outcome. And right now we're just getting our teeth into the analysis as we pivot to the next stage, which will be the exposure draft. So it's been a good few months.
Oh, well, it sounds like we caught you at a very good time then for the consultations. And it's so wonderful that you've had such extensive engagement with this project. With Charity Fraud Awareness Week just around the corner, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on fraud in the NPO sector.
Yeah, so I think sometimes there's this sort of fairy tale notion that everyone working in the nonprofit sector runs their tanks entirely on altruism and is 100% motivated by the cause, so there couldn't possibly be fraud. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there is an abundance of generosity and mission passion in the sector. But there is also fraud. And if you think about it, they're actually particularly vulnerable, I would say, for two reasons. Firstly, NPOs tend to place executive control in their founder or their executive director, especially smaller ones. And since they often focus their funding on their core service, they can sometimes overlook crucial areas that, like accounting or internal controls, financial oversight. Functions that are of vital importance, especially when one individual wields significant influence. And then I think secondly, another vulnerability actually relates to the sector's key superpower, which is the frequent use of volunteers. And volunteers are sometimes not trained in internal control processes. They may be privy to confidential information. And frequently, even the board of directors is comprised of volunteers, and sometimes they might not have, you know, financial oversight expertise. And I think, you know, the third area actually is that nonprofits always want to invest as much as they can on line service delivery. And that can actually result in an underinvestment in internal controls and fraud prevention and things like that. So I think there is a particular vulnerability in the sector. My personal experience, I've lived in Uganda for 20 years and I've had more firsthand experience than I would have wished. But it's really not surprising when you look at the fraud triangle and pressure, opportunity, justification that we all know. Those are all common. So, you know, fraud happens. I should just say that just because my experience is mostly in Africa, I wouldn't want to create the impression that it's absent in other types of countries or any other types of organisation in the sector. I really think, you know, the sector isn't immune.
No, and I think that's the great thing about IFR for NPO is you've got such a diverse range of subjects that you're trying to draw data from. So I don't think anyone would mistake you for a painting with a broad brush. Have you noticed any major trends lately in respect to fraud being carried out in the NPO sector?
I would say there are two big trends that I've seen. The first, let me be clear, I don't have hard research data on it. It's a bit more anecdotal, but just an increase in cyber types of fraud, which I'm sure is similar to other sectors. You know, the phishing, the email fraud, the mobile money scams, as many organizations have moved their operations online. But, you know, the old frauds are still pretty common. The collusion with suppliers, the expense claims, cash theft, payroll fraud, etc. Then there are some frauds that are really quite unique to the sector, like requesting bribes for access to grants, or double funding fraud and skimming money from donations before their bank. So the fraud is still there in the sector. But I think the second trend is really exciting. I don't think it's pandemic related, it's a sort of longer term trend, but there's a really strong sense that transparency and openness about fraud, for example, in annual reports, is actually really important to build trust sort of externally. And then internally as well, it's becoming more of an expectation that an NPO would have a fraud policy. And there's this growing awareness that fighting fraud requires a more holistic approach than just zero tolerance statement and some internal controls. We hear people, you know, talking much more about culture and a stronger focus on understanding relationships outside the organization as well, with donors, suppliers, grantees and beneficiaries. So I think there is a strong positive trend in terms of transparency, which is very positive.
Well, it's good to hear that, you know, in spite of everything, we still got some positives emerging from the pandemic. You mentioned there something called double funding fraud. I was just wondering if you'd go into a little bit more detail about that.
Yes, so double funding fraud, that's when an organisation reports a certain cost to one donor, let's say, I don't know, maintenance of boreholes, which they really do, and the money really does get spent. But then they report the exact same costs to a second donor as well. And the donor-funded projects are, I would say, particularly susceptible to this if they focus only on accountability for the money that they have given, rather than understanding the finances of the entity for a whole. Because even if you do project level audits, they would struggle to spot this type of fraud. So it is something that donors are particularly nervous about. The other area where we see this nervousness is around admin or indirect costs, where donors want to be sure that they're not paying for costs that are also being covered by someone else.
Great, thank you for explaining that. I think the pandemic has seen an uptake, especially in people interested in getting involved in organisations like charities and NPOs, which help other people. What would you expect the broader impact of this guidance, once it's published, to be on people getting involved across the sector?
Well, I think it has most impact and relevance for the, firstly, for the preparers and auditors of financial reports of nonprofits internationally, and crucially on the readers themselves. And they might not necessarily be accountants. They might be board members, they might be civil society, they might be regulators. So the impact of this particular project is really about building trust and credibility and transparency within the sector, especially in countries that don't have their own national guidance. I think the other impact we'll see with more consistency is that basically grant making should become easier, and it should make the flow of funds into the sector easier. This is what we saw. If you think of, you know, IFRS or IPSAS in the last few decades, it has opened up capital flows into those sectors. And that's what we would hope to see as the sort of longer term impact.
And finally, once the international guidance is published by IFR for NPO, how do you think this will help prevent threats like this being carried out in the future?
Such an important question. So the guidance is yet to take shape, but there are some approaches and alternatives that could really shine a light on this problem. If the presentation of the income statement, for example, has columns for different funds, and or if the notes show the movements on each donor fund, it'd be easier for users to see the relationship between a particular grant or project and the entity as a whole. Now, obviously, in the UK, a charity SORP, that is a norm, but most countries don't have an equivalent national standard, and there's no international standard. So that's something that could really be helpful internationally. There's also a proposal for the annual accounts to include a separate schedule showing more detail for movements on material funds, which could be audited as part of the general purpose financial statements. So again, that could shine more of a light on the relationship between project and entity-wide transactions. So I think it's fair to say that in general terms, if we improve quality and consistency of financial reporting in the sector globally, that has a real impact on the foundational infrastructure for accountability and transparency. So it's not a magic bullet, but it's all part of an environment where it's harder for fraud to thrive in the end.
Wonderful. That's great to hear. While we're waiting for the international guidance to be published, are there any currently free resources available from Humentum or IFR for NPO that organisations can look to for guidance?
Absolutely. So Humentum actually has an anti-fraud policy template on its website. It's free to download and for any nonprofit to customise so that it can meet their needs. It's really as a tool just to help the sector fight fraud.
Great. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today, Samantha.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Samantha and Ursula, for keeping us updated on IFR for NPO's progress and the fantastic work it is doing. Now we are going to pivot slightly to the forthcoming spending review and hear what it may mean for local government and the health and care sector. So the first question for you, Joe, in case any other listeners aren't familiar with what a spending review actually is, could you briefly explain what it means, how often they happen, and why they are so important for local government specifically?
That's a good question, actually. I think often people talk about spending reviews without really knowing what they are. But a spending review is essentially where the Chancellor sets out what the government is intending to do around public spend. It's different from a budget. It's really important that we understand about the spending review because we discuss, you know, billions of pounds of public money in these events. Sometimes that can be hard for people to get their heads around because the figures and the amounts that we talk about are so significant. The other thing about a spending review is that it allows government to tell people about their policy objectives and how they're intending to fund them, sort of almost a bit of putting your money where your mouth is, which is, again, very, very important. We have in the past had spending reviews where they have provided a longer term financial outlook, sort of 3 to 4 years. But in recent times, sort of 2019 to 2020, we have sort of only had 1 year spending reviews, and that's been quite a challenge for the sector.
Thanks, Jo. So obviously we have just had 18 months of unprecedented demands and pressures placed on local government. What do you think are now the most significant challenges local authorities are facing as we emerge from the pandemic and back into some semblance of normality?
Well, I think there's some really key challenges that the sector's gone. I'm not going to talk about social care because I know that Ellie will do that in far greater detail than I can, but that's an important area and it certainly dominates local authority spend. But we've also got things like the allocation of funding, which is quite dated and complex. And there's been concerns around things like funding for net zero. There's a clear lack of direction and funding support for local authorities at the moment, delivering on that really important policy agenda. The continuation of COVID pressures, both the increased demand and the reduction of income, is causing concern because there's starting to be identification of a gap that's causing. Then you've got sort of particular sector areas of concern. So, for example, perhaps districts, they're around leisure services, which have been really badly hit by COVID. And, you know, how are they going to keep those going? There is concerns about some of those services being shut, and yet they're so important, particularly about sort of public health and prevention. And we've also got issues around schools funding, particularly with DSG and concerns. And finally, homelessness. Obviously, we had some specific impacts around COVID where evictions stopped. And, we're, you know, coming out of that, that has now changed. And so we will see some people losing properties as a result of the financial pressure around COVID. So we've again got that additional pressure coming on board.
I'm just going to come to Ellie now, if I may. And the health and social care levy was big news for the sector recently and will bring about the biggest reforms to the sector in a generation. But is it just plugging one hole while creating another somewhere else? How does this levy fail to address some of the urgent challenges in the care sector specifically?
I think you're right. I think plugging one hole while creating another somewhere else is a good way to present it. Remember, of the £36 billion to be raised by the levy over the first 3 years, only 5.4 billion of that is being allocated to social care. This might just cover the funding reforms announced at the same time as the levy. That's the cap on care costs and the extension to the means test. While these reforms protect individuals from facing catastrophic costs to their own purse, they actually increase the cost of social care to the public sector. And remember, these are not new. We have been here before. Similar reforms were on the table a few years back, but they were repeatedly delayed and eventually discarded. So although the funding reforms on the table protect individuals, they do nothing to address the numerous and urgent cost and demand pressures, nor the workforce shortages in the social care sector, all of which have been putting pressure on the sector for many years and have been exacerbated by the pandemic. Instead, the government were clear in their recent policy document that these pressures must continue to be met from council tax and from efficiencies, which local government have been struggling to make for quite some time. Many authorities might actually have to counteract the more generous means test by restricting access to service through the eligibility criteria just to manage demand. You could say that the government has perhaps shifted the political blame to local government, who may be forced to restrict access to services and raise council tax just to deal with a shortfall in social care funding. The government have, however, committed to a white paper for further reform, which we hope will address these pressures once and for all. But meanwhile, the spending review really has to provide councils with certainty that they need, that they will have adequate funding to provide sustainable social care services and to support the providers in their area post-pandemic.
So just following on from your point about what the spending review needs to provide, may I go to Jo and ask in your opinion, what does a spending review need to provide local government to address some of those challenges which you spoke about before?
I think, first of all, the spending review, it would be great if it provided some long-term funding solutions. We have some hope on that. And certainly in a letter sent to the sector, they talked about a longer term spending review, which is really good news, because what that means is it allows local authorities and those in the public sector to plan better. And if they're able to plan over sort of medium to longer term, what that means is you get better value for money and delivery on that. There's concern certainly over council tax and sort of reforms to business rates. So we need to keep an eye on the pressures on council tax. A reduction in the sort of competitive funding pots would be another thing that we would like to see. We picked this up in a briefing that we did on grants a couple of months ago. And also it was picked up in the National Infrastructure Commission report recently, because sometimes that mechanism doesn't allocate where funding needs to go, can often favour those that are better at competing those bidding funding pots. Perhaps continuation of support for post-COVID costs would be another thing that we would like to see. The problem with that is that nobody's quite sure what those demands are going to be. And I would suggest that there is a risk of greater pressure rather than less pressure as a result of that longer term. And then finally, I suppose, the need to respect authorities' requirements around reserves. At this time, particularly around the spending review, we often get a real call for local authorities to sort of call on their reserves and to use those reserves. But we need to ensure that those reserves are also there to level out, you know, the peaks and troughs in local authority spending. So if they are going to call on reserves, we need a way of recouping those as well. And they can't just be something that is looked on to balance budget annually, because they will run out.
Thanks, Jo. So, Ellie, I would like to ask you about integration. And at the Conservative Party conference, their health secretary promised fundamental and far-reaching reform in relation to increased health and social care integration. The Health and Care Bill, which will create integrated care systems, is currently working its way through Parliament. For this integration to be a success, what does the spending review need to do to support this?
I don't like to sound like a stuck record here, but again, social care funding is a huge issue for us. Even NHS colleagues across the board are recognising that without reform and adequate funding, the social care sector is struggling to meet demand. So finding the resource for service transformation to support integration is even more challenging. I think the language around the bill and the integration conversation has changed slightly in a very welcome way, in that it's speaking more about focusing on prevention and addressing health inequalities, particularly in light of the experience of the pandemic. And a crucial player in this regard is public health, which perhaps doesn't have enough of a starring role in the integration discussions. We've seen changes at national level in that we now have an Office for Health Improvement and Health Disparities, but the pandemic highlighted the crucial and essential role of public health at local level. Yet in recent years, we've seen a real terms reduction of around 25% in the public health grant. At the very, very least, this needs to be restored in the spending review, as it runs contrary to the policy rhetoric around tackling inequalities, improving prevention. And again, it limits the contribution to integration of this essential player in the integration game.
So if you could have just one wish which would be granted from the spending review for your sector, what would that wish be?
Call me ambitious, but I'd like to take it a little bit beyond my sector. In an ideal world, I would like the spending review to put a much greater focus and provide more headroom for investment and prevention and wellbeing across all public services. This would go a long way to reducing the costs of health and care, as we'd be less in need of responding to crisis and illness. As it is, many services are barely meeting demand and they don't have the headroom for these investments. And quite often, as we've said before in our work of 2019 in this area, it's quite often the first tap that gets turned off when budgets are stretched. Now, we recognise that the public purse strings are extremely tight right now, but we need to start learning these lessons of the past and realise that without such investment, we'll need to keep spending money on meeting demand in the here and now, rather than improving the health and wellbeing of our population and reducing future demand, so making our public services more sustainable for our future generations.
And Jo, if you could have just one wish which was to be granted from the spending review, what would be your wish?
I think to find a long-term sort of sustainable solution to local government funding. You know, it's probably not just me that would like to see that, but a recognition throughout the sector, work that they do and the importance that they play. If you think about the role they played in the COVID and protection of vulnerable people, that funding stream needs to be strengthened. We need a more diverse funding stream and we need to reflect that. And I think that revolves around the fact that we probably will have to make some really difficult decisions over the next couple of years about how that's done. If you think about the pressure of going on to council tax at the moment, so the IFS recently reckoned just to keep level, council tax would be increasing by sort of 3.6% on average in England over the next sort of 3 years. So significant pressures on individual people with budgets. So I think that a longer term solution and combining that with a more outcomes based approach to delivering public services and aligning local public services across the piece, which I think would generate better value for money in those services and create better outcomes for individuals within our communities.
That was Joanne Pitt and Eleanor Roy speaking about the forthcoming spending review. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's edition, but don't despair, as we will be back soon with more guests, more questions and more things which public finance professionals need to know about. Thank you for listening to this edition of Sipper Speaks.